Accession number 10885, Reel 2.
Lillian Cadoux, Reel 2.
Reel 2.
My mother didn't want me to marry him. And she fastened on the particular objection that his father had been German. And made herself eventually so unpleasant that she just frightened him off. And I was desperately unhappy about this. And blamed her and decided this was it. I was aged 21. I wasn't going to live at home any longer. I would have liked to join the VADs. That was the sort of military arm of the Red Cross. But there was a waiting list. And so I joined the other branch. They called that Civil Nursing Reserve. Much better for me, as it later turned out. And I went to a hospital in Barnet. And I thoroughly enjoyed the work. I really loved it. I felt at last I found my vocation. Doing something that's interesting in every way. And I love the contact with the people. So I shall take up nursing training. And unfortunately, in one way, because I never became state registered, I moved to a different hospital, which wasn't anything like so well run. But I'd mistakenly supposed that it would be better. And this one was in Edgware. And I made friends with a girl called Olive Jarvis. I felt an instant attraction towards this girl. The very first day I met her. She was a bit shy and retiring, and after a few weeks, she suddenly said to me one evening, "I have something to tell you, and perhaps when you know it, you won't want to know me any longer." And I thought, oh dear, she's going to tell me she's pregnant, because that's the thing that used to be happening, you know, that was this devastating news somebody might have to tell somebody else. And wasn't that at all. She said, "I'm a pacifist." And I said, "Well, what are you worrying about? Because, you know, I wouldn't stop being friends with you because of that. In fact, I think I'm a pacifist myself." So I think perhaps by this time I'd already read Vera Brittain and started to think about that absolutely appalling waste of lives in the First War. I think I must have read her by that time because I was so ready to embrace these ideas. So Olive and I became closer than ever. And she was a keen member of the Youth Hostels Association. We went to a social event run by the local group. And I found myself another boyfriend. And he also was a pacifist. So you see, the threads were all coming together. Quite an extraordinary way. And then Vera Brittain came and spoke in Edgware. And I sat and hung on every word as if she was a high priestess or something. Well, things went from bad to very much worse in that preliminary training school at the hospital. We had been 7 when we started. And by the time we'd taken our PTS exam, I think there were 3 of us left. And there was a great tragedy. One of the students was a woman of 35 who had grabbed this as her last chance of nursing training. Up until that time, they hadn't let people take it, you know, at such an advanced age, but she had been an assistant nurse and was an absolutely first-rate practical nurse with a lovely temperament. I had worked with her when we used to work in pairs. And because she hadn't got an academic mind, she failed this preliminary exam. And it affected her so badly that she drank carbolic in the duty room. I think even this episode has something to do with my pacifism, because I think it confirmed me in a dislike of the establishment. Rather unfeeling organisations. None of the senior nursing staff had seen or cared much about the difficulties of that particular nurse. And certainly her suicide made Olive and me decide that we had to leave that hospital. We couldn't stay on any longer in that atmosphere, despite the fact that we were their 2 best students. And my friend Olive said, I know what we can do. We're of the age in which we might be called up, probably would be called up, as soon as we left this hospital. But she had by that time already had contact with friends and had worked part-time for them. And I had been aware of friends, of course, for many years, because Friend's house was so near where I lived. So we presented ourselves in their personnel department, and they sent us to a residential hostel. I think it was in Chalk Farm. And next door was this large house which was used as a workshop, where the young men renovated, donated furniture, and we 2 girls dyed huge rolls of material to cover the furniture with.
So were you official members then of any particular Friends organisation? The fact that you were working there?
We'd been accepted as Friends Relief Service members.
How does the Friends Relief Service, how did that differ from the Friends Ambulance Service? Was it the fact that there was a greater variety of tasks rather than as the FAU name implies, that it might be more medical relief?
Yes, certainly the FAU is much more medical. Friends Relief Service did nothing in hospitals as far as I can remember. The greatest difference of all was that Friends Relief Service was much more Quaker orientated. They had a higher percentage of Quaker members. Their office was actually in Friends House. Everything that they did was governed more directly by Quaker principles than the FAU. The FAU office was in Gordon Square, was autonomous, and had quite different types of people, quite sophisticated people, top people from the BBC, more worldly. Yes, much more worldly people. Friends Relief Service were absolutely wonderful for plugging gaps. The government had thought about evacuating school children, pregnant women, mothers with young babies, but had done nothing about old people and certain types of disabled. And with their usual acumen for this sort of thing, the Friends stepped in very, very quickly and bought up large houses. Or maybe they rented them, I wouldn't know about that. But got the use of them in some way so that they could very quickly house elderly people who'd been bombed out of the large centres. They also had a wonderful project in Bournemouth, which I heard about, because, of course, I worked in two of the residential hostels, but I didn't, in fact, participate in. I just visited. Very, very poor EastEnders had been evacuated there, and it was found that they were unacceptable to their host families because they didn't keep themselves clean, they didn't know how to do housework, they didn't know how to cook, they'd lived in such terribly, terribly primitive conditions. So the Quakers set up a day centre and taught them all of these things and I suppose made them much more acceptable to their potential hosts. Yeah, that was the thing I admired enormously about Friends Relief Service, this plugging of gaps.
Was there any sort of feeling between the relief service, Friends Relief Service and the FAU, would you say?
Yes, I think there was. There would certainly be a great mutual respect because the FAU men were often a great help to us with their vehicles, for instance. Very skilled drivers of heavy vehicles would transport the furniture and so on and so forth. There was a lot of cross-fertilisation. I'm sure it was some of the FAU men who came and did the renovating and repair work in the hostels. But my impression is that in general, speaking, you know, very widely, the FAU probably looked upon the FRS as being slightly stuffy, and FRS probably felt we are proper pacifists. We will not go abroad to do relief work until we can wear Quaker grey and give a witness. Because everybody who saw them in the street would know that they were Quakers. Whereas if you went on relief work in the FAU, you wore khaki. Certainly we had very distinctive shoulder flashes with the Red Cross on. But one has to think of the effect upon people seeing you in the street. Yes, we looked like members of the British Armed Forces. So to that extent, there was just a little bit of underlying feeling.
How about yourself, Lillian? Did you feel like that?
Well, during the war, I knew practically nothing about the FAU. Nothing at all. After all, I quickly left London. And didn't come into close contact with FAU members until I took my training for relief work abroad.
Did you have to face a tribunal?
Oh, no, I didn't. But you see, being so idealistic and terribly, terribly romantic and having heard Vera Brittain, I was prepared to virtually be martyred, you know, for my newfound faith. And I can clearly remember sitting up till 2 a.m. in my bedroom in this Bournemouth hostel writing out my statement. I think I would have positively welcomed a tribunal. I would have loved it because that gave me the chance to declare what I stood for. But the tribunal never came. And I was pretty sure that it was because of this particular service that the FRS was doing for the government. Here were we two girls, having given up nursing, but doing work that nobody else would do. You know, if they'd have put us all in prison, who would have looked after these old people in these hostels? So, my chance of a bit of drama was dashed.
Did you feel deprived of giving your witness? Was that an important part
yes.
of it?
Yes, it was. Yes, because I'd done a lot of reading up all of these First World War experiences, and there was my proof that it wasn't going to have solved anything, and I was going to drag in the Treaty of Versailles and everything, you know. Yes, I felt very deprived of that opportunity.
Another thing, what pay were you getting with the Friends Relief Service?
Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. 7 shillings and 6 pence a week.
How would that have compared with what you were getting from your tobacco firm beforehand, or say nursing? Was this going down?
No, I don't think it was going down for me. Not having been trained for anything at all, financially, I was worse off than these girls who'd gone to the technical colleges, went straight into well-paid jobs in offices. When I was in nursing, I only got 11 and sixpence a week, and all found. Yes, you could put it this way. I did go down by 4 shillings a week.
Could you manage on that, you know, 7 shillings a week? You know, could you keep yourself?
Yes. You managed extremely well, because after all, clothing was rationed anyway. Your dental charges were paid by FRS. And it used to cost something like a shilling to go to a dance. I mean, it wasn't easy. But after all, I'd always been accustomed to making do and I can't remember ever being troubled by the lack of cash. In fact, having learnt to smoke in hospital, because I'd done night duty, which was extremely stressful, and then observed that the night nurses smoked, so there must be something in it, I can remember I could still afford to buy cigarettes. Then, of course, I'd have been an extremely moderate smoker. So it can't have been a very great disadvantage. I think we got travel to London paid as well. They probably paid people's fares home wherever they lived. So there were a variety of reasons for not feeling particularly hard up.
How were you responding to the events of the war? Because after all, there were things like Dunkirk and then this great fear of invasion, wasn't there, at the end of 1940, the beginning of 1941. Did this present you with dilemmas or any doubts about the way you were going? Can you remember? No, would you say there was quite a lot of pro-war propaganda about this?
I always refused to hate the Germans. That was something I was adamant about. And of course, when the war first broke out, you didn't have to hate the Germans. I can't consciously remember, but probably after Dunkirk, I did dislike. I can remember so disliking Churchill's attitude. I really loathed that voice rolling out of the radio, promising to, I can't remember exactly what he did promise to do to them, drive them into the ground or something terrible. That had a really, really powerful effect upon me.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because often he's thought of such a, his speeches, morale boosting.
No.
It didn't have that effect on you, it would appear.
No. No, they made me feel very sad. And something else that made me feel very sad, I was an agnostic, but used to think, well, you know, give religion a chance and attend the local church wherever you happen to be. And so I went to an Anglican service in Bournemouth. And it put me off the church, and certainly put me off British propaganda, because the minister preached some sermon about blessing all of our tanks and planes and weapons of war, and annihilating the Germans.
Do you think, given the relationship between church and state in Britain, that's almost inevitable that the church would take that attitude?
Well, of course, but I was very intolerant in those days and didn't understand.
What do you think the church, you know, the priest should have been preaching?
Well, an agnostic has a very idealistic view of religion and thinks everybody who purports to be a Christian, would follow Jesus in every way and show compassion and love. I'm a pragmatist now. Don't expect things like that.
So in the FRS, what actually were you doing? You know, having gone to this factory and renovating the furniture, what other tasks did you do, Lillian, before you went overseas? Is there anything that, you know, impressed you a lot, the work you were doing?
Yes. I would imagine that the project we were on came to an end because the... donated furniture had all been renovated and sent off to the hostels. And so I was sent to help in the hostels for the old people and discovered very quickly that I had a lot of rapport with the very old. I positively enjoyed the work. I used to do... well, I was a maid of all work. House cleaning. Funny what you can adapt yourself to when you've never done it in your life before, because my mother always used to say, get out of my way, I can do it faster myself. I mean, when you live in two rooms, you don't exactly train your young daughter up into... cleaning and cooking and so on and so forth, but I just learned all those things as I went along in the hostels. And by and large, I had a very good relationship with the wardens and their wives, except for one thing, my frivolity. I can clearly remember that lovely warden of that Bournemouth hostel saying to me one day, oh, Lillian, I do wish you wouldn't wear lipstick.
Would this have been sort of unquakerly?
Absolutely. I was about to say, this showed, again, this difference between FRS and FAU, I think. He said it in the gentlest possible manner. But you see, I didn't particularly want to be Quakerly. I just wanted to work for a pacifist organisation. So there's a conflict here. And in a way, it's a very great pity that I didn't know about the FAU at that stage. A terrible pity. Would have fitted me like a glove. So I struggled on, you see.
Were there any other sort of frustrations, like, well, perhaps frustrations is too strong a word, but were there any other sort of instances like that where your sort of norms of behaviour conflicted with the FRS?
Yes. Although the wardens didn't come out with this at the time, again, with hindsight, I'm practically sure that they disapproved of my going out dancing. They disapproved of my generally flighty attitude, and they were quite right too. At one stage, I was literally chasing one of the men, young men in the hostel. I must have been a real problem to them. I can see it all now.